This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, July 19, 2004. I'm Nell Abram. Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Correa says his resignation still stands. The FBI is interviewing Muslims and Arabs across the nation. Trade unions and immigrant rights groups rallied across the country this weekend after the White House killed two proposals designed to help legalize the undocumented. And today marks the 25th anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution. We'll have a special report from Nicaragua. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The United States launches an airstrike in the Iraqi city of Fallujah, reportedly killing civilians. And a popular Iraqi cleric is allowed to reopen his newspaper after being closed down by the U.S.-run provisional authority. Dave Enders has more from Baghdad.
U.S.-appointed Iraqi Prime Minister Ayad Alawi announced this weekend that Al-Hawza, a newspaper run by supporters of rebel cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, would be allowed to reopen after it was shut down in April by occupation authorities. Alawi's public overture to al-Sadr means little as far as the newspaper is concerned. It continued printing, even after its closure, under different names. What it does signal is a further willingness to bring Sadr into the political mainstream, and the cleric made his first public appearance in some weeks yesterday. Alawi this weekend also approved yesterday's U.S. bombing of Fallujah. Doctors there have told news agencies a number of women and children died in the attacks, which U.S. officials say hit safe houses for anti-occupation forces. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Lebanese officials charge Israeli intelligence operatives killed a Hezbollah leader today. Mohammed Shablak reports from Beirut.
A senior official of the Islamic resistance of Hezbollah was killed in a car blast early this morning. 40-year-old Ghalib Awali died when his car exploded as he was turning the engine on, leaving his home in a suburban Beirut neighborhood. Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, accused agents of the Israeli Security and Intelligence Services and Networks, Mossad, to be responsible for the assassination. Nasrallah also doubted a statement from a Sunni Islamic group claiming to be behind the operation. He is blaming the Israelis for stirring conflicts between the Sunnis and Shiites in Lebanon. Some say that the Israelis are the only experts capable of the proficiency used to set the bomb in this complex way. Till now, the Israeli government is silent regarding these accusations. Retaliations at the south borders are expected in the next 24 hours. For Free Speech Radio News, Mohammed Shablak, Beirut, Lebanon.
Organizations MoveOn.org and Common Cause announced they are filing a petition against the Fox News Channel with the Federal Trade Commission. Nadja Middleton explains from WBAI.
The petition asks the Federal Trade Commission to stop Fox News' use of the slogan Fair and Balance to describe itself. Shelley Pingree is the president of Common Cause. After the press conference, Pingree marched to Fox News headquarters and posted the petition on the side of their building.
We're saying that Fox is doing deceptive advertising here. We don't mind their free speech rights to say whatever they want. We just don't think that they should call it Fair and Balance.
Pingree was accompanied by volunteers who distributed free copies of Robert Greenwald's documentary entitled Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism. Last December, the Independent Media Center filed its own petition against Fox News. In it, it demands the cancellation of Fox's registered trademark so that the news channel is not granted the exclusive rights to use the words fair and balanced. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Nadja Middleton in New York.
Women of color are reporting discrimination in the workplace at rapidly rising rates, while the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is slow to act, despite having similar data. From D.C., Claudia Sachs reports.
Discrimination in the workplace continues to affect minority women, according to a recent study done by the National Partnership for Women and Families. The report reviewed 10 years' worth of discrimination claims provided by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, concluding that women of color, as well as older and immigrant women, are especially likely to experience certain types of discrimination. While discrimination claims filed by white women decreased, those filed by black and Hispanic women have increased by as much as 68%. The National Partnership for Women and Families says that society has seemed to forget about the significance and persistence of discrimination. They believe that the EEOC must look at its discrimination statistics in more sophisticated ways that better identify the specific problem areas needing enforcement. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Claudia Sachs.
The NAACP, at the end of their annual convention in Philadelphia, voted in an emergency resolution to call for a new trial for journalist and activist Mumia Abu-Jamal. Abu-Jamal has been sitting on death row for 23 years after a jury declared him guilty of killing a police officer in Philadelphia. His supporters say the case was contaminated by racism. Only two members of the jury were black, while 11 other African Americans were turned away from the pool by the prosecution. Key evidence against him are the statements of three witnesses whose testimony has serious flaws, according to his lawyers. The case is now awaiting what is likely his last appeal. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Kouraya today says the resignation he tendered this weekend remains in force because he hasn't received a written response from Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Kouraya's resignation coincided with a shakeup in the leadership of overall security in Gaza. Arafat appointed his nephew, Musa Arafat, as head of security in the Gaza Strip, leading to huge unrest over the weekend. Today he nullified that appointment and reinstated Abdelrazak al-Maheda to the post. Dr. Hassan Abu Libda is the bureau chief and cabinet security minister of the Palestinian government. Dr. Abu Libda, what implications do you think the resignation of Prime Minister Kouraya will have on the peace process and the security situation in the region?
Well, I mean, definitely if he resigns, the peace process will receive a very serious blow because he's a peacemaker. He is one of the founders of the Oslo process, and he is in very good position to deliver strategically on the final status negotiations between Israel and Palestine. On the security issue, I don't think it is that serious. I think the security situation in the region is already in very bad shape anyway, so I don't think his resignation will add to the already bad situation that we are in.
Thousands of Palestinians demonstrated this weekend. 18 people were injured overnight in Rafah during armed clashes between security services and fighters from the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. Dr. Abu Libda, do the events of this weekend illustrate the importance of restructuring security forces as a major component of the peace process, or are greater issues being ignored?
Well, I mean, first of all, the events of the weekend have opened very widely the issue of the restructuring of the security apparatus. Therefore, in this regard, I think these events will never, come down and bring things back to the situation that existed pre the weekend. I think the restructuring and the uniting of the security forces has already started, and this is by default. On the other hand, I think, of course, there are so many other issues that have to be addressed concerning the working of the PA, the relevance of the PA vis-a-vis the way it provides services to its people, because the Israeli government and the Israeli military has basically suffocated the PA abilities, and they are continuing their campaign of destruction and assassinations and so on.
Some suggest that the continued breakdown in the region is a result of a divide-and-conquer strategy on the part of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, and that his pullout proposal is actually intended to create a power struggle between Palestinian factions. Do you think that's an accurate assessment?
I'm afraid so. I'm afraid this is probably one of the dividends that Mr. Sharon sought when he put forward his proposal for the unilateral disengagement. And unfortunately, there are also those Palestinians who are not so far-sighted, who started the power struggle for grabbing their own or enhancing their positions in Gaza in the aftermath of the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza.
That was Palestinian Bureau Chief and Cabinet Security Minister Dr. Hassan Abu Libda. Last week, Congress passed a free trade agreement with Australia, which is just one of several new free trade deals that are either being considered or have already been approved. One constant amongst the agreements is that while tariffs would be dropped on such sectors as manufacturing, U.S. pharmaceutical companies have been successful in blocking the imports of cheaper drugs. With many trade deals still in the air, this year's elections could prove crucial to the future of free trade. Mitch Jezerich reports from Washington, D.C.
The Bush administration has been negotiating several free trade deals with numerous countries in the last year. By the end of last week, Congress overwhelmingly accepted a free trade agreement negotiated with Australia. If the Australian Parliament also accepts the deal, manufactured goods will be duty and quota free, and textile and apparel tariffs will be phased out. Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa is a sponsor of the measure.
And the freer the trade around the world and the fairer the trade around the world, the more opportunities there are for our consumers to buy whatever they want to and the quality they want.
However, not everything is free about the Australian FTA deal. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zolik included in the agreement the prohibition of pharmaceutical imports. The pharmaceutical industry, which is a large donor to both Senator Grassley and President Bush, has been successful in ensuring that the free trade agreements negotiated so far will not allow for the importation of cheaper drugs. Republican Senator John McCain, along with a majority of both Republicans and Democrats, voted for the agreement. However, McCain, who has recently endorsed the president's re-election bid, blasted the Bush administration for its cozy relationship with the pharmaceuticals.
And when Americans wonder how this continues to happen, maybe they should take a glance at the list of intellectual property, quote, advisors that worked with the negotiators. These advisors include representatives from, guess who? Drug companies. Guess who? The pharmaceutical industry as a whole, and other lobbyists with a direct interest in blocking drug importation. How many public health and consumer advocacy groups? Zero.
Free trade is an obvious election year issue, with many pending FDA negotiations waiting to be either ratified by Congress or signed by trade representatives. Democratic presidential candidate Senator John Kerry voted for the first major agreement, NAFTA, back in the 90s. Though Kerry still maintains the support of free trade, he also says as president he would review all pending agreements to ensure they include labor rights and environmental standards.
We can negotiate a raising of the standards of labor, of environment. The United States could be the marketer of sustainable development practices, of technology transfer, and still open markets for us. We need to export our capitalism and our democracy, and they go hand in hand.
Chris Slevin with Public Citizen says Kerry's approach is a step in the right direction, but Slevin says penalties for labor and environmental violations don't normally work.
If a company is using an unfair labor practice, they just have to pay a fine, and a fine does nothing towards amending the problem. It just becomes another cost of doing business.
The Central American Free Trade Agreement, also known as CAFTA, appears unlikely to get a congressional vote this year, and its future may depend on the November elections. John Kerry has indicated he would reject CAFTA as is and would renegotiate it to include environmental standards and worker rights. The group League of United Latin American Citizens, also known as LULAC, was a strong supporter of NAFTA 10 years ago. But now, according to LULAC's Gabriela Lamas, it's not supporting CAFTA.
Our undocumented immigration has, from Mexico specifically, has more than doubled since the passage of NAFTA. And we believe that much of it has to do, in particular in the rural areas, with the displacement of agricultural workers. In the case of CAFTA, CAFTA doesn't even appear to have many of the same provisions that would look at those kinds of issues.
As for other candidates, the Green Party's David Cobb says he would pull out of NAFTA and CAFTA altogether, while independent candidate Ralph Nader says he would renegotiate NAFTA and the WTO to ensure environmental, labor, and human rights protections. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
In what the FBI claims is an effort to gather intelligence about possible al-Qaeda attacks in the U.S. in the coming months, members of Muslim and Arab communities across the country are being interviewed. Legal experts and community organizers are warning that anyone contacted should obtain legal counsel, and many are curious about the relevance of the questioning. Darby Hickey reports.
Recent converts to Islam are the newest terror concern, according to notes taken by attorneys and legal experts who have sat in on the newest round of FBI interviews of members of Muslim and Arab communities. According to the FBI, the interviews are part of the response to increased concern about al-Qaeda attacks during the summer political conventions or the fall elections. But the interviews are causing more harm than good, says Benefsha Akhlawi, a civil rights attorney who has witnessed several interviews.
These second round of interviews are nerve-wracking to me. I don't know who they think they're going to be able to reach from these interviews, if anything will come out of it, if the intelligence is even accurate. I can't also understand what the basis for the questioning would be, because the questions seem so arbitrary and so random as well. Do you know anyone who has any ill will towards the United States?
According to Akhlawi and others, FBI agents asked about recent trips to select countries like Pakistan, Morocco, and Bosnia. Interviewees also have been asked about specific organizations and individuals. Some were asked about their personal lives, like what mosques they attend, or their opinions about the war on Iraq and the current regime in Syria. Stacey Tolshin is with the National Lawyers Guild and observed one interview.
Even though they had said that they were looking for people who were like Jose Padilla or Richard Reed, you know, I asked them if they were going up to Marin, which is where, of course, John Walker Lind was from. And they said, no, we had no plans to. So I thought that was interesting, because if they're telling me they're looking for recent converts, they should be going outside of traditional Muslim centers.
Benefsha Akhlawi says that the newest round of interviews contradict the FBI's stated attempts to form new and positive relationships with Muslim communities.
It doesn't seem like there's any basis to connect them except for their country of origin. So again, it's more racial profiling. It's again more discriminatory conduct based on a country of origin or religious base selection.
Muslim and Arab organizations say they are concerned the interviews will result in punitive measures taken against community members for immigration violations, as has happened in the past. The FBI did not respond to calls by FSRN by deadline. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey of the DC Radio Co-op.
Trade unions and immigrant rights groups rallied across the country this weekend after the White House squashed two measures designed to help legalize the undocumented. In the central California town of Porterville and the coastal town of Watsonville, hundreds of workers with the United Farm Workers of America rallied in support of a measure called Ag Jobs, which would allow undocumented farm workers to earn the right to stay in this country legally. Meantime, student demonstrators rallied outside the Texas state capitol and at a speaking engagement of Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist in Nashville, urging lawmakers to support the DREAM Act, which would allow undocumented immigrants who entered the United States before age 16 to qualify for federal college loans and work study. After registering for college, immigrants would be given temporary legal residency and could win permanent legal status if they earn a degree. From Los Angeles, Aaron Glantz has more.
It seems another year may pass with undocumented immigrants receiving no help from Congress. That's bad news for Cynthia Hernandez. The Santa Monica City College student came to the U.S. from Veracruz, Mexico, when she was 11.
The DREAM Act, it's a bill that will allow a lot of students, undocumented students that came here since they were young, the age of 10, 12 years old, and now they're studying at the university and colleges. But the problem is that once they finish, they are undocumented, they won't be able to do their careers. Why? Because they are undocumented. They don't have no papers. So the DREAM Act would allow this, all these students to continue working and legalize them. It's my situation, and I'm worried because sooner I'm going to graduate from university. What am I going to do? Be stuck there, so desperate because I don't have appropriate papers, you know?
The White House's opposition to immigration reform took many activists by surprise. Particularly shocking for them was the administration's opposition to ag jobs. The bill was sponsored by Republican Senator Larry Craig of Idaho, one of the Congress's most conservative members, and was co-sponsored by more than 60 other senators. Hardly radical, it would only grant legal status to undocumented farm workers if they had been working in the U.S. for years, and only if they continued to work in the fields. Those coming after the bill passed would be covered by a guest worker program and would never be allowed to achieve citizenship. It seemed to follow on George Bush's request for a law allowing immigrants into this country to do jobs that he says pay too little for the native-born to do. Here he is announcing the plan in January.
I propose a new temporary worker program that will match willing foreign workers with willing American employers when no Americans can be found to fill the jobs. This program will offer legal status as temporary workers to the millions of undocumented men and women now employed in the United States
and to those in foreign countries who seek to participate in the program and have been offered employment here.
Now, though, the White House maintains the bills represent a threat to national security that could help terrorists to become legal residents of the U.S.
George W. Bush, Capital Bay, SMSI.
In his campaign for president, George Bush rarely mentions immigration. He has spent millions of dollars on Spanish-language TV ads, but most of them are attack ads like this one, which accuses John Kerry of missing two-thirds of his votes in the Senate and of voting against a bill pushed by anti-abortion groups that would have made killing an unborn child a crime. Eliseo Medina is vice president of the Service Employees International Union. He doesn't think the ad campaign will work.
If the Bush campaign wants to win Latino and immigrant votes, I would suggest that they save their millions of dollars in advertising and instead focus on fixing our broken immigration laws. Because when it comes to the November election, immigrants are going to take to heart that American axiom of don't listen to what they say, watch what they do.
John Kerry has pledged his support for both measures, though neither Ag Jobs nor the DREAM Act for college students will help most of the estimated 8 million undocumented immigrants who live in urban areas. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Los Angeles.
As the election season heats up, activists attempting to ensure voting accuracy have been gaining traction and visibility around the U.S. Last Tuesday, organizations with combined membership of 3 million Americans converged on 19 state capitals around the country demanding verifiable voting in elections. Reports are still coming in from that flurry of activity called the Computer Ate My Vote Day. For instance, activists in Albany, New York rolled out a literal paper trail from the west steps of the state capitol to the front entrance until stopped by state police. The activists then rolled up the paper trail and delivered nearly 42,000 signatures to Governor Pataki calling for a voter-verified paper trail. Pokey Anderson updates this story with news from Ohio and Texas.
The grassroots movement to ensure accurate, verifiable voting gained a victory on Friday. The Ohio Secretary of State, Kenneth Blackwell, halted all Diebold electronic voting machines in that state for the November election. The Ohio decision was based on problems found in a second round of security testing. Blackwell said, "I will not place these voting devices before Ohio's voters until identified risks are corrected." Unquote. The headquarters of Diebold is in Ohio, and it was the CEO of Diebold who had created a furor by saying he would do everything in his power to deliver the electoral votes of Ohio to George W. Bush. The Ohio action follows a similar action by the California Secretary of State. Activists in Texas are waging the battle on numerous fronts: publicity, petitions, pending lawsuits. Susan Bright is an Austin poet and publisher at Plainview Press. Bright and a friend were concerned about whether hanging chads are going to be replaced by hacks and glitches, and came up with the idea to put up 6 billboards around Austin. It generated an enormous amount of attention, and a dozen or so people with $50 each could do a billboard in their own community, she says. Susan Bright's group is offering the artwork free to other activists. But that's only the beginning. The Texas voting activists, armed with 16,000 signed petitions, held a packed press conference with people spilling into the hall next to the ornate rotunda of the state capitol in Austin. The Texas Secretary of State, Jeffrey Connor, was a no-show, but promptly issued a statement characterizing the citizens as, quote, special interest groups. The Secretary of State's statement charged that, quote, some wish to cast a cloud over our elections or create a sense of uncertainty and paranoia, unquote. Given the political landscape in Texas, Susan Bright says,
there are lawsuits in place in about 8 states. There are some being filed as we speak in Texas. It's a national emergency, this disregard of the principle of verified voting can affect everyone, and we could end up having an election which is a battle between hackers.
People at the press conference in the Texas Capitol were outraged at the chatter about possibly suspending national elections in case of terrorist attack, and it was roundly denounced by everyone speaking. Bev Harris, author of Black Box Voting, said she is also concerned about a different possible disruption. Disruption of printing paper ballots.
All of the optical scan ballots and all of the absentee ballots for all Diebold systems in the United States are going to be printed in one place. Everett, Washington. They have no backup plan. They're having a little problem. They laid off half the staff, and the other half of the staff decided to unionize and is threatening to go on strike.
Harris is incredulous that there is no plan B to print ballots. Andy Stevenson, her colleague at Black Box Voting, is a big guy and he doesn't take any guff from the voting machine companies.
I've been threatened by these people. I've been followed from my home to work. The president of Diebold told me to back off or I would get a visit. It's wrong. We're privatizing our elections. It's something that should remain in the hands of the people. If they take our right to vote away, we're nothing but slaves.
Andy wrote a little song especially for his Texas visit.
Rigging vote machines is fun.
Paper trails to you. We can steal your vote.
Reporting from Austin for Free Speech Radio News, this is Pokey Anderson.
Today marks the 25th anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua. This revolution became a target of U.S. President Ronald Reagan, who saw the Central American country as a crucial game piece in the Cold War. Tara Ramos brings us the following special report from Managua.
25 years ago today, the main plaza outside the destroyed cathedral in Managua overflowed with people as news spread that Nicaraguans had succeeded in their efforts to overthrow dictator Anastasio Somoza Jr. After over a decade of struggle against the dictator and his brutal National Guard, the Sandinista Front of National Liberation had won. Once in power, the Sandinistas organized and mobilized an entire population in health and education campaigns, and they carried out massive land reform programs. These actions led to the eventual attack of the Sandinista Revolution by U.S. President Ronald Reagan. William Rodriguez of the Center for International Studies in Managua.
O sea, este proyecto de consolidación de la revolución popular sandinista ni siquiera logró consolidarse.
The popular Sandinista revolution didn't even get a chance to consolidate itself, because outside the country, war against Nicaragua was already being decided. When Ronald Reagan's administration came to power, remember that in his electoral campaign, he accused Jimmy Carter's weak policies of having allowed communism to grow, and Reagan made us, Nicaragua, part of the famous Cold War. He involved us in a Cold War that we lived hot. We lived it hot because here was where the consequences of that war were lived. He began military aggression against this country, and he made economic war also through a blockade.
In 1990, the U.S. succeeded in its goal of thwarting the Sandinistas when the U.S.-backed candidate Violeta Chamorro was elected by an exhausted Nicaraguan populace. After her election, the U.S. ended its decade-long war and blockade against Nicaragua. As it shifted towards a neoliberal model, creditors like the International Monetary Fund began giving Nicaragua loans for development. As a condition of receiving these loans, Nicaragua is made to comply with structural adjustment programs that these creditors designed for them. In Nicaragua, this has meant cutbacks in government spending and privatization of state institutions. Magdalena Villarreina is a 62-year-old woman from the northern province of Estelí.
Right now, the situation is hard. My God, with these governments that we've had lately, we have gone through a crisis that you can't even imagine. We've suffered hunger, suffered everything. A pound of rice costs 7 cordobas. A pound of beans, 7 cordobas. Everything is so expensive. The salaries don't give enough to buy anything.
Many Nicaraguans say that the situation today is comparable to times before the revolution, when Nicaragua lived under a dictatorship. Father Fernando Cardenal was Minister of Education under the Sandinistas and Director of Nicaragua's Literacy Campaign.
Before July 19, 1979, there was an economy similar to the current one. There was a small group that was well off economically, but the majority of the population was in a situation of poverty and extreme poverty. Today, this is worse than before. There is also something that is new today. There is no bloody repression. No one is killed because they're against the government. These things did happen during Somoza's time. Now there is freedom of press, freedom of opinion, freedom to gather, but economically, it is still a disaster here.
Today, when Nicaraguans look for the democracy that the U.S. promised them in 1990, they find a government weak and corrupt, made of elites that are only concerned with foreign interests and personal gain. This July 19th, the main plaza in Managua fills again as people remember the hope-filled moment of 25 years before. Reporting from Managua, Nicaragua, this is Tara Ramos for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Nell Abram.